This is a continuation of the discussion following the lecture, The Origins of the Economic Crisis and the Way Out, given by Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. This program was sponsored by the Madison Institute and was held in Madison, Wisconsin on April 24th, 2010.
Dean, this is a follow-up question, really, but how do we get the political will? Because the president can always take us to war and wave the flag and be heroic and get billions and billions and trillions of dollars in war, which is as wasteful as you can get. But we can't get the same thing to build our infrastructure, to improve our domestic society. One is considered un-American communistic. The other is considered, well, they don't consider it killing. They consider it something good. But how do we get the political will, the people, to say, we won't put up with this anymore? I don't have the answer, but...
Well, I can't say I have the answer either, but I think the first part is just getting under discussion. And there were some efforts recently, and I wish I could remember who was leading this, to simply have the, you know, proposing that we pay for the war in Afghanistan, you know, that we have some offsetting budget cuts, which we wouldn't want this year, or tax increases, but, you know, in some future years. And the idea is at least get that discussed, that this does cost money. So you have this idea that somehow, you know, we're talking, you know, we had this big battle over extending unemployment benefits. I think it was $18 billion we're fighting over. We had this big battle over it, but somehow all the money that goes for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, you don't even talk about. Well, the first thing is just talking about it. And, you know, you get into this, like, almost ungodly, stupid conversation. You go, okay, you might think the war is great, but it still costs money. You know, and just say, okay, let's talk about the money. Because they really do their best just to say, oh, that's over here. We don't talk about that. So the first step is just insist that we talk about it. And, you know, it's fine. You know, World War II, you know, I don't want to see all those people killed, but I think it was right that we, you know, fought the Nazis. You know, so yeah, it cost a lot of money, but that was the right thing to do. You know, so you could say, I think it's totally wrong, but you could say, yeah, we should be fighting the war in Afghanistan and it's worth the money. But if you aren't prepared to say part two, then we shouldn't be fighting the war, right? You know, if you don't think it's worth the money, then we shouldn't be fighting it. So I think the first thing is just say we have to talk about the money. You know, so if we're spending it there, then that's, you know, that's a real commitment of resources, and we should be prepared to say then that it's worth it.
I was struck by the idea that the financial transactions tax might raise about $100 million a year, because it's about the number that you would need to finance the healthcare reform. And it brings home to me the point that I think it's a question of priorities. But my question is, in the 1930s, when the Securities and Exchange Commission was set up, one of its principal tasks was to break up the public utility holding companies. Is anyone looking back to the experience of what happened in that context with respect to the question of breaking up the large banks?
Someone probably is, but I have to say I don't know who. You know, again, we get kind of this silly argument that the, you know, among economists, I'm not going to say there's a consensus, but you have a lot of economists from, you know, across the political spectrum. Even Greenspan came out for breaking up the big banks, but Thomas Hoenig, who's the head of the Kansas City Fed, and I've always thought of him as a very conservative economist, he came out for breaking up the big banks. There's a lot of people. Simon Johnson, of course, has been very visible, the former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He holds the chair of, called something like Free Enterprise at MIT. I mean, so he's not someone you'd think of as being a real radical, and he's been very outspoken for breaking up the big banks. So you have among economists, and again, I don't mean to overplay this, there are many economists who say you don't have to, but you have economists across the political spectrum that are saying we have to break up the big banks. But when you get to the political arena, it's really, you know, just kind of anathema. So we do have some good people like Sherrod Brown and Senator Kaufman from Delaware prepared to champion that. But, you know, boy, the Obama administration's running from that like crazy. So we haven't had a serious discussion. And that's why I made a point with saying earlier, you know, I actually get people saying, well, how would you break that up? Like, that's this really hard thing. And yeah, I don't know how to break up J.P. Morgan, but that's, of course, a silly, silly question. I don't have to break up J.P. Morgan, you know. So we haven't had a serious discussion of it. There's just too much power involved.
I've been listening to your recommendations with great interest to see if there's anything that's applicable to a state. And I don't see a lot. We don't have the same kinds of economic power that the federal government does. What would you recommend to state leaders or to the things that we can do to advantage a particular state in the current economy?
Well, one thing that certainly can be done at the state level, I did mention that WorkShare actually exists in 17 states, and I wish I could tell you. I did look at one time, and I cannot remember whether Wisconsin is one of them or not. But, you know, WorkShare is something that can, you know, is done at the state level. I mean, it'd be great if the federal government came through with a lot more money for it and really promoted it and had a more flexible program. The programs that are in place date back from the late 70s and early 80s, and they're overly bureaucratic. I mean, they were designed for a different era. You know, the economy's changed a lot in 30 years, and they aren't well publicized. A lot of people don't even know about them. I actually was at some meeting once. There was this guy who's a major steel company, a Fortune 100 steel company, and he was boasting about how, you know, they have a no-layoff policy. He's telling me he cut back their hours, but we haven't laid anyone off. And I said, oh, that's great. You know, do you take part in these WorkShare programs? He's looking at me like, huh? What? You know, he didn't know anything about them. Now, I don't know if he operates in any states that have them, but it just he didn't. You know, this guy runs a big company, didn't know anything about him. So, you know, those have to be modernized. States that don't have them, I think, you know, if you could get them in place. Again, unfortunately, there's a lot of there's probably lead time. It's probably not something you can do in 2010. I don't know if you could do it in 2011. I mean, even if you had everyone in the legislature go, oh, yeah, that's what we want to do. I don't, you know, there would be some time involved in setting that up. But that is certainly one thing that could be done at the state level. Some of the other things, I mean, there is a lot of research at this point. I've worked with some people on this that shows, you know, a lot of, well, Joe Rogers, who does work here with COWS, the Center of Wisconsin Strategy, has done a lot of this, actually showing that there's big returns to retrofitting buildings. And I know you have some programs here already to promote that, but those could be expanded so that basically the idea is that the government puts up some money up front to give people the capital they need to retrofit their home to make it more energy efficient, and then that's paid back through time. So it's not there's a little money out of pocket, but you get that back, and you could get you could be sure you'll get it back because you could do it through utility structure. So it's you know the house is attached, there's a fee attached to its rate structure, so you know it will be coming back. So that's something that could be done. You know, some of the other things, you know, certainly financial regulation. Well, one of the things you can try to do, and I've talked to some people about this, North Dakota has a state bank, and I think that's a good model. Now, I don't want to get too carried away with this. I don't think you could revolutionize your economy with the state bank, but I think it's had a positive role in North Dakota, and I see the idea of having state banks as something like the public option in, you know, the healthcare debate, that, you know, if you have a well-run state bank, then that sets a model, shows what can be done, provides credit maybe to some people that wouldn't have gotten it through the private system, but sort of keeps them honest that, you know, here we're able to get loans through the public bank at this cost. How come we can't do it through the private banks? But it is important that you not overly sell that, because you can't, if you go out and have a state bank that's just lending money to everyone, well, it's going to lose a lot of money, and you'll just get a lot of people pissed at you because you can't, you know, you can't just open the vaults and hand out money like crazy. So I think it could have some impact, but it can't radically transform things. Other issues, certainly having minimum wages that, you know, you could raise them somewhat. I mean, at this point, there's a lot of research on that. And, you know, again, you have to be reasonable. We can't give minimum wage of $15 an hour. You will lose jobs, but, you know, you could certainly up it some above the federal minimum and benefit people at the bottom. And, you know, there's some bumping up effects. So I think that's a good thing. I mean, one of the things to keep in mind, if we had the minimum wage just at the same value it was in the late 60s, I haven't checked this lately, but it'd be around 10 bucks a day, 10 bucks an hour today. So, I mean, the idea that we can't have the same real value of the minimum wage in an economy that's more than twice as productive, it's a little crazy. So, you know, maybe you don't get there overnight, but, you know, we can get there. So those are a few things. I mean, there are things that could be done at the state level. I mean, I have to say, well, Parvs, I live in Washington, so you naturally your first inclination is think of Washington. But you know, to some extent, the states are kind of like Greece. You know, Greece is very constrained in what it could do, because, you know, it is in the Eurozone, it's very much constrained what it could do. And, you know, a state like Wisconsin, most states are very much constrained. But there still are things that you could do better and end up with better outcomes than, you know, if you don't do them. So I wouldn't say they're trivial. They can make a big difference.
Good morning. I have a question of more personal nature. We have a business that that builds a very high-quality, super energy-efficient home and have been fairly successful over 25 years in selling our product. These days, we find that that we're hanging by a thread, because the people that would like to work with us are having trouble getting money at the banks. I mean, these are very high people with very good credit ratings and very highly qualified, and they can't get the money. What is the problem here?
You know, that's it's an interesting question because, you know, I follow the data on that very closely. And I have to say there's not evidence in the data that people are having trouble getting mortgages. I mean, I hear the accounts, but, you know, you look at the data. The reason I would say this, the clearest way it would show up in the data is you'd expect to see a lot more mortgage applications than mortgage approvals. So there should be a rise in the ratio of applications to approvals. There isn't. You know, the Mortgage Bankers Association puts out data on that every week, and there's absolutely zero evidence of any rise in the ratio of applications to approvals. So I just, you know, not to say, I'm sure there are people, you know, particular individuals that are in that situation, but it doesn't seem that that's in general a story around the nation, because it just, there's no evidence at all for that in the data.
Yeah. Joseph Stiegel, it's in his book, The $3 Trillion War, says that most economists now believe that military spending hurts the economy. Unfortunately, your recitations about World War II and Klugman's recitations about World War II suggest otherwise. The facts are that in 1941 and 1946, the economy are the same, adjusted for inflation. Check it out. Go look at the U.S. Statistical Abstract, the bicentennial edition from 1899 to 1976, a complete, honest set of economic facts. And I think you're ignoring the role military spending caused after 9/11, those 2 years, it caused 1.7 million jobs to be lost, by my calculations. 1 million due to trade treaties and 1.7 million due to the military buildup, and that explains the 2.8 million lost during that period of time. But other than that, back to the topic at hand, I believe that the setup for this situation in the economy is like the one in the 80s, where you had a military buildup, four times the growth rate on the East Coast in California as in the Midwest for 5 years, creating a huge real estate boom in those militarized areas of the country, leading to the S&L bank bailouts at the end of that decade when that housing bubble boomed and busted. And we have almost identical situation today, an East and West Coast military buildup that led to a corresponding housing boom, which overshot and crashed. And ever since the surge began is when the unemployment rate started surging as well. So the military budget is very much tied into these current events.
Well, just very quickly, again, the context in which military boosts the economy is in the context of having a severely underutilized, a severe amount of underutilization, a large amount of unemployment as we had in the Depression. So if you had World War II or World War II type spending during a more normal economic period, I don't think there's any doubt it would be a drain on the economy. At the same time, I don't think there's any doubt that it created a lot of jobs, led to a huge increase in output. Well, we had 46, there was a recession. 47, the economy bounced back. So we had, so I don't, you might, in terms of the real estate, I think you'd find very weak correlations. I mean, there was a bubble, a big bubble in Chicago. That's not exactly a hotbed of military spending, at least not that I know of. You had a lot of cities that had real estate bubbles that I think you'd find very hard to correlate with any sort of. So I think you'd be pretty hard pressed to find any very close correlation between, you know, where the military spending was and the bubble. Also, I should point out the bubble began in the 90s, at a time when we were actually cutting back military spending. So, I mean, it really doesn't fit very well. So I don't like the wars, but I really just don't see how that story fits at all.
I've got a question that might be a little naive, but I'm sort of a blame seeker, and so I'm looking for help there. I'm inclined to think that this bubble or the financial collapse that occurred, the derivatives and the financial instruments and the exotic instruments and how that whole market went off. But when I coffee clutch with my conservative friends and we're drinking coffee and they say, no, the problem was the well-meaning liberals who, Chris Dodd, Barney Frank, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and so on, putting people into housing they couldn't afford. So if you want to seek the blame, find the blame, place the blame, it's on that segment of it. So I'm just curious, is there, you know, plenty to go around and 30% goes this way and 40%, 70% goes that way? I'm just curious your take on that.
Well, to quote my hero, Dick Nixon, I'm glad you asked that question. That story is 99% nonsense, and I'll give the 1% of truth to it at the end. But the 99% nonsense, so first off, they blamed the Community Reinvestment Act. And this one, when I first heard this, I thought, you got to be kidding me. Community Reinvestment Act, this is Carter-era legislation. And what it says is that banks have to lend money in the communities where they take deposits. And, you know, I've known friends and did housing work for years and years. And, you know, if you ever see the Community Reinvestment Act, they go, yeah, who cares about that? I mean, they liked it. They were glad it was there. But, they knew it was basically toothless. You know, it's not that they could go down to the bank and go, hey, you know, you're not, you know, they had to issue some data about, you know, where they're making their loans. But it's not as though anyone, you know, you had some government regulator saying, we're going to put you out of business because you haven't been made. And it just didn't happen. I mean, the best thing they could say for that was that when they wanted to merge, they could have hearings about that and, you know, cause them some grief. But, you know, they were not making loans because of the Community Reinvestment Act in any big way. And then somehow that this became heavily enforced in the Bush administration. I mean, that strains things a lot. But then you go a little further, go, okay, so Community Reinvestment Act, you have to make loans in the communities where you take deposits. Well, a lot of the big actors in subprime, people like Countrywide, people like New Century, they weren't deposit-taking institutions. They were getting their money on Wall Street. The Community Reinvestment Act did not apply to them. Okay, it didn't even apply. Furthermore, where were they making loans? Well, a lot of the loans were made to exurbs. You know, they have these new communities outside. So the communities they were making loans to, it didn't apply. So you have, like, nothing fits. You know, so it's there's absolutely zero there. Now, Fannie and Freddie, okay, were they the big troublemakers? Well, what was new in this era was the private issuers of mortgage-backed securities. So what was going on was that you had Goldman, you had Citigroup, you had Merrill Lynch, that they said, hey, we're not going to leave this to Fannie and Freddie. We're going to step in. We could issue mortgage-backed securities. We're real smart guys, and we're going to pick up this market. And what did they do? They got the junk mortgages. They were the ones that took the subprime, that took the Alt-A. They were the ones that did it. Fannie and Freddie just took prime loans. That's what they were there for. In fact, Alt-A means alternative to agency. So that means it didn't qualify for Fannie and Freddie. Now, at the end of the day, Fannie and Freddie did get in 05. They jumped into that market, and the reason for jumping into it, it's very clear. They were losing market share. Okay, their businesses, they're going, oh my God. And I have a report from, I believe it's Moody's, that said they're talking about Freddie, but I'm sure that he has something comparable about Fannie, saying, you know, we'd be concerned about the rate at which they're losing market share, but they're going to get into these, you know, Alt-A, these exotic mortgages. So that we're okay with that. So it wasn't, you know, Barney Frank and Chris Dodd and the liberals that pushed them. It was they're looking for profit, and they were losing their market share. Now, again, they weren't heroes. I debated their guys. I said, there's a real big housing bubble. You guys should be cutting back your loan. And they're just, no, everything's fine. But they weren't at the forefront of the subprime and Alt-A pushing the junk mortgages. Far, far from it. You know, they did eventually jump in, but that was in response to profit. Now, the grain of truth to this is you had a lot of people, some on the right and some on the left, who said, oh, this is really good for poor people, moderate income people to become homeowners because that's how you're going to build wealth. And there were a lot of foundations that I'm a little hesitant to say this because we get money from some of them. But there were foundations that said, oh, this is great. We're going to make poor people middle income people by helping them get into homes. And they in the middle of this said, oh, it was a great idea for you to buy a home in 04, 05, 06 at a bubble inflated price. That was a really clever thing for you to do. So they deserve some blame that way. But this is, you know, like the 1% of the story. I mean, they should have been, I wish they were out there saying, hey, there's a housing bubble. You're not going to help a moderate income person by getting them to buy a home at a bubble inflated price. That's not the way to help them. But they were out there saying, no, home ownership's good. But it was not Fannie Freddie. It was not the CRA.
So you're saying, since debt isn't an issue, we can print our way out of this, as in the Carter years, and have 18% inflation, which should be our friend. And the second point I'd like you to address, The FCC spent $20 million on the broadband plan, and your firm was involved in this. Can you tell us how much your firm received for helping write the broadband plan?
Yeah, that's really simple, zero. We weren't involved in it, but you know, if you have some money we can get, I'm happy to hear about it, but we weren't involved in it. In terms of inflation, again, inflation is a process in the real economy. We got inflation. There are two reasons we got inflation in the late 70s. One was we did have an economy that was somewhere near full employment. So you had this process of high of wages, pushing prices, pushing wages, and also you had a quadrupling of oil prices, which had nothing to do with what Carter did. What we had a quadrupling of oil prices from, and by the way, inflation only got 13%, so it wasn't 18. But in any case, that came about from the Iranian Revolution, and I don't know that printing it money here had anything to do with the Iranian Revolution. They cut off oil supplies from Iran at that point. They were producing 6 million barrels a day that basically went to zero, and that had a very big impact on world oil markets. So, you know, I don't see a connection between printing money. Now, again, in terms of, you know, what I'm talking about in printing money, the idea is that we have an economy below full employment. So if we print money, we could generate jobs and put people back to work. How does that lead to inflation? You know, I sort of scratch my head and go, I don't really see that. You know, I don't know any firm that raises their prices because you go, oh, the Fed just printed money. I'm going to raise my prices 10%. I mean, if one of the stores here in Madison did that, I think everyone would just go to the other store. You know, I'm a believer in markets. You know, that's what happens.
I noticed that one of your first option in terms of the crisis was talk about it. On one issue that I have, I really like to talk about it, and I think we are all here because we like to talk about these things. But the ideology out there and the propaganda machine doesn't seem to listen when we talk. So I'm curious as to how we break through that barrier. But the main thing I wanted to say was that there's an area I'd really like us to be talking about, and you did just mention the word jobs. I want to know where on earth we think those jobs are really going to come from, because anybody that's been in the workforce for the last decade has seen jobs being cut and jobs being cut and people being replaced, and people either have a job with far too much work to do that they can do in the hours, or people have no jobs. There isn't very much in between. Work sharing is a terrific idea, but I don't see it working against the kind of pressure to eliminate employment. We've had 1 week job, week recovery as far as jobs is concerned. It looks like we're sure in another one. Is there any kind of policy that you can imagine being introduced, and be real creative here? What kind of policies are going to return people to the workforce?
Well, again, this is really much more a political question than an economic one. We can spend money. We can push work sharing. I mean, employers, they're not vindictive in the sense that they aren't saying, oh, no, I will never think of hiring, you know, two people working 20 hours, or, you know, let's say three, make the arithmetic a little more complicated. Let's say, you know, five people working 32 hours rather than four people working 40 hours. It's not, you know, what the hell they care. You know, they'll do whatever's cheaper for them. And if you structure it so it's cheaper, they get tax credits to do the latter rather than the former, they'll hire more people. So we can do that. It's, you know, it's just a question of political will. And, you know, basically think of politicians, you know, I use this analogy. It's, I suppose, somewhat degrading politicians, but it's appropriate. They're there to get elected. They're going to follow the path of least resistance. So, you know, the idea that we're upset that President Obama didn't do what progressives want him to do, or our representatives in Congress, they're there to get reelected. So you go to President Obama, go, here, I have this great idea. Go, okay, but how's that going to help me get reelected? You know, and same thing with your senators, same thing, your members of Congress. It's all a political question. How do you make it unacceptable? So they've got it in their head. It's unacceptable to talk about bigger budget deficits. I can't do that. It's acceptable to say we have 9.7% unemployment. That's acceptable. But talk about bigger budget deficits, that's not acceptable. And what's really incredible, and this is, again, worth emphasizing, you know, I'm usually a doom and gloom guy. I don't have to be. The projections that are coming out of the White House, coming from the Congressional Budget Office, those are really, really gloomy. So they project that we're going to have unemployment averaging 9% next year, 8% 2012. They don't project that we get back to full employment, something close to full employment, until 2016, 2017. So that should be unacceptable. But as it stands now, we have politicians who could sort of go, hey, what can we do? And you go, well, you could spend lots of money. No, that's not politically acceptable. So it's a question of moving what's politically acceptable, and it's really hard to do. But the first thing, as I say, is to to show what isn't what's possible. And that's why, you know, when I talk to people about Germany and the Netherlands, people usually think I'm making it up and go, no, here's the data, you know. We can do things to sustain high levels of employment. We're just not doing them because our members of Congress don't feel the pressure to do it.
Along those lines, what about Senator Dodd's effort to have a reform with the financial reform? Is it possible that we could have a bipartisan approach to anything, or are we just stuck this sort of vicious situation?
That's a really good question. I've been sort of struck. I mean, I've been around Washington a long time, and before, I mean, I grew up in Chicago under the real Mayor Daley, as we like to say. And, you know, so I'm used to kind of cynical politics. You know, I remember Daley once got caught. He'd given some big contract to his kid who was just out of school, and he'd gotten a job with one of the insurance companies. So he'd given a big no-bid contract to the insurance company and got caught. And Daley just said, well, if a man can't help his son, well, you can kiss my ass. And, you know, and Mike Royko, our great columnist, said they had to call in ushers to deal with the line at the rear. But anyhow, I think the Republicans have really taken the cake on financial reform. So they're saying, you know, they've been trashing the Dodd bill, that this is a bailout bill. And again, I'm the first to say this is not sufficient to prevent bailout, but we are in a bailout regime. So it's not that now if we have the Dodd bill, we're going to be bailing out banks, whereas we weren't before. I mean, this is close, like, you know, we were here in the fall of 2008. We remember this. So they're literally saying night is day. And they're prepared to do that if the media will let them. And that's what they're betting on. So that what they're betting on is that you get this he said, she said. They could say literally anything. I mean, you remember Sarah Palin's death panels. I mean, what the hell was that? And I write for one of they have these two D.C. publications. I don't know how widely they're circulated outside D.C., but a lot of people in D.C. read them, Politico and The Hill. They're circulated among Congress people, their staffers, lobbyists, policy types. So they send out a question every day, and I mentioned both of them because I can't remember which one sent me this question. But the question was, is Sarah Palin helping her political career by engaging President Obama in a debate on end-of-life care? She's not engaging him in a debate on it. She's making shit up, you know. But why shouldn't she do that? You know. So if the media just, you know, you could say anything and they'll just treat it as, you know, perfectly reasonable. Okay, and what do you say? Then the Republicans have this incentive. Sure, it's a big bailout bill. That's why we oppose it, because they're going to bail out. So it makes it very hard. And, you know, what we have to try to do, I think, is pressure the media here to say, you know, a good reporter says the Republicans are making things up when they're making things up. And the Democrats make things up, too, sometimes. I mean, they're, you know, it's bipartisan. They both do what they think they can get away with. But the fact of the matter is that the Republicans are doing it much more lately than the Democrats. And I think to change that, they have to pay a price that, you know, they should have front page stories. You know, hey, the Republicans just, you know, they're making this stuff up. Well, here's what the bill says, and they're saying it's this bailout bill. It's just an invention. So that's what I think we'll have to change. I think there is some hope. We'll see how this comes out. You know, at the end of the day, they got the health care bill through. It was not my model bill or anything, but they did get it through. And I think they will get this through. And I think what happens once the Democrats are able to start passing things, you change the incentives for the Republicans because they don't want to be seen there as obstructionist. And, you know, they start to break up. Instead of being a solid block, 41 Republicans in the Senate, you get, you know, Scott Brown from Massachusetts goes, I am up for re-election. I can't tell everyone. I just say no to everything, you know. So you get people breaking off saying, I'm going to do what's going to get me reelected, which isn't necessarily sitting with the 41 Republicans.
I'm Buzz Davis from Stoughton. I'm a member of Veterans for Peace, and I'd like to bring up the issue of the moral and empire side of military spending. So military spending in the United States has doubled in the last 20 years or so, now $700 billion or so a year. Finances a tremendous empire of military bases and cooperative agreements with military forces all over the world. And so if we were to down the size of the military spending and up the size of, for example, single-payer health care at $1 trillion a year, and then fully fund some sort of public sector jobs program for the 15 million unemployed or so, then what kind of ramifications would that have in our economy? Losing, expanding.
Yeah. Well, from the standpoint of the economy, there's no doubt about it. The military spending over long term is a complete waste. And again, as I say, it creates demand in a context where we couldn't otherwise have the demand. So if we can get Congress to say, okay, we're going to cut back the spending over here, and we're going to use it for jobs program, we're going to use it to provide health care, you know, X, Y, and Z, we could put a lot of things on that list, then that certainly is a boost to the economy. I mean, basically, military spending is the same as paying people to dig holes and fill them up again, although they're also killing people, but ignoring that part. But from the standpoint of the economy, it's the same as paying people to dig holes and fill them up again. So it's just total waste. So if instead we could use that for productive activity that's going to improve our infrastructure, improve our education, give us a better trained, better skilled workforce, then you know we would receive real dividends from that. So there's no doubt about it. It's a cost to the economy, but again, it has to be framed in the context that it's this or this alternative spending that we could be doing. If it's, you know, again, and I'd like to see it, so it's not that I wouldn't want to see it, but if I was snapping my fingers and, you know, we got out of Afghanistan and Iraq and cut back that spending and the base elsewhere, that would hurt the economy, at least in the short term.
You said that it would be useful to bring down the value of the dollar relative to other currencies. Can you say something about government policies that would make this happen?
Sure. The government, you know, under Clinton, it's actually very interesting. Clinton, when he originally took office, had a policy that he would let the dollar fall. And, you know, the dollar, of course, did fall in his first years in office. That was kind of the textbook, what was supposed to happen. They made this decision that their priority was going to be deficit reduction instead of public investment. And the rewards of deficit reduction were supposed to be lower interest rates, which on the one hand might promote domestic investment, but more importantly, would lower the value of the dollar. And if you go back, 93, 94, the dollar did in fact fall. And Lloyd Bentsen, who was Treasury Secretary at the time, basically said that was fine. So he never said, I want the dollar to fall. But he said, you know, I'm happy to have the dollar seek its level. Something, you know, he made statements like that. That turned around with Rubin. Rubin said, no, we want a strong dollar. And the muscle behind that was the IMF back when you had the East Asian financial crisis. And that's when the dollar really did rise a lot. Now, if we were to flip around, there's a number of different tactics. I mean, I think the first thing would just be saying as a target that we would actually like to see the dollar fall against, you know, whichever currencies. The big issue that we hear about is with China. And, you know, I think I don't know what takes place in the discussions with the Chinese government. I'm not in the room. But I think what's probably the case is we've made it clear to China that it's really not a priority that we'd like to see the dollar fall against the yuan, or to put it the other way, the yuan rise against the dollar, same thing. We say that publicly, and we ostensibly are saying, you know, we really, really want you to do that. But my guess, and I've more or less had people confirm this to me, is, you know, we have a shopping list. We want our financial industry to have more access there. We want you to enforce Microsoft's copyrights. We want you to enforce, you know, the patents that Pfizer has. You know, so we have all these different things on there, and one of them is we want you to raise the value of the yuan. So it's on there, you know, China looks at the list, and, you know, these are negotiations. They decide, okay, we'll give you one, we'll give you a little two, we'll give you a little three. They don't raise the value of the yuan, or at least not very much. So we could, as a matter of policy, say, no, this is really important to us. This is really front and center. We want you to raise it. And the U.S., actually, I mean, we often portray this that the U.S. is helpless in this story, and it's a little silly. You know, the U.S., China fixes the value of its currency against the dollar. If we really wanted to, you don't want to be in this situation, but if we really wanted to, we could fix the value of the dollar against the yuan. So they say, these are approximate numbers, they say that, you know, it's 7 yuan to a dollar, that's the current valuation, you know, puts the yuan at roughly 14 cents. We could say, no, it's 5 yuan to a dollar, we'll give you 20 cents. You come to the Treasury, we'll give you 20 cents for each yuan you bring there. And if we did that, if we were actually prepared to honor that, that would probably make that the official value. That would make it the, in effect, trading value of the yuan. If everyone knew they could come to the Treasury and get 20 cents for a yuan, that would raise the value of the yuan. Now, you don't want to be in that situation, but if, you know, if we really were insistent with China's government, they said, no, we're not going to do it. You know, we're set on this. It's 7 to a dollar. We could just go, well, as of January 1st, 2012, anyone comes to the Treasury, we're going to give them 20 cents for a yuan. And, you know, my guess is that if we convinced them that that was actually what we were prepared to do, that we would have a back and forth and we would work out an orderly process through which the yuan would rise relative to the dollar. So the U.S. is far from helpless in this. We can bring down, it's usually the opposite story. Nations have a hard time keeping the value of their currency up, but bringing it down really isn't hard to do. We could you know, throw money, throw dollars out in the world, and that will bring down the value of the dollar. So we know how to do that. We've just made a decision not to do it.
Hi, I'm Sue Holmes from Glenville Timber Rights in Baraboo, and we do have customers coming through the door at the same rate. We have 19 clients on the books right now who are ready to go. 7 of them cannot sell their homes in order to finance the new home. These are homes that are designed and ready to go. 12 of them cannot get loans. These are medical doctors with paid-up medical schooling, with houses that they maybe owe $100,000 on, who would like to put an addition on. Yeah, 3 perfect credit scores, have been to 8 different banks and cannot get the money. We also have a multimillionaire right now who has more equity in the land that he wishes to build on. It's a fifth generation business, and he cannot get the money. This has gone on for the last year. So in the meantime, we know how to put these people to work. Local contractors are waiting to step forward to be able to do subcontracting work with us, and the banks won't lend the money. We're so frustrated with it that at present I am setting up a listening session with local contractors and small business people, and the Small Business Administration will sit on this panel at the University of Wisconsin, Baraboo. May 20th is when we're setting it up for, at 7 p.m. I've tried to get a hold of Russ Feingold through his scheduler. If anyone here has any special pull to get Russ here, please help me out with that. But we hope to have this listening session. Another thing that the banks are doing right now with the small business people, and I don't care if you've been with your bank for 20, 30 years, the line of credit is being cut back. If you have a $70,000 line of credit, you pay off $30,000, well, guess what? Your new line of credit is $40,000. Many of the small businesses are being cut to have the line of credit changed into a promissory note. So I'm wondering if in our area we're being targeted as redlined, or are they pre-reviewing us? What is happening with the banks? We have the clientele who are ready to build, but the banks won't lend the money. Thank you.
Yeah, I have to say, man, I don't know any of the specifics. I'm not, you know, I don't know the specifics about either the industry or Wisconsin's economy. As I could just say, it doesn't, the fall off in lending doesn't surprise me nationwide, given the severity of the downturn. But, you know, what's going on in a particular area, I just can't speak to.
Hi. Every Friday or Saturday morning, we hear on NPR that more community banks have been closed and their assets have been transferred to great big banks. This, of course, ends community ties to these banks. It makes service a lot harder to get. Can you tell what the effect of these closings is on the survival of small communities and why the FDIC is doing this?
Well, the FDIC is closing banks because they are insolvent. I mean, that is pretty much what they're supposed to do. We are losing, I think there were 5 banks that were closed yesterday. We are losing banks, and we're going to lose more. I don't think there's any two ways about that. And when you do get a situation, you know, there's a lot of evidence show this, and it's not surprising that when you have a branch of a large bank, they're much less likely to make loans to the local community. They'll make them wherever. Some of them will be in a local community, but many of them will be elsewhere, anywhere around the country, anywhere around the world. So, I mean, I think it's not a good thing. It's not that easy to avoid, though, where you have an insolvent bank. The FDIC is obligated to basically take it over. They could try to work out an arrangement where, you know, someone else maintains it as the existing bank. You know, in other words, someone, you get new owners, but that's not always easy to do. So, they're in a situation where they either have to sit on the bank for a long period of time and run it themselves, which they certainly don't want to do, or alternatively sell it to whoever's willing to buy it. So they tend to go the latter route, and that does tend to lead to more consolidation. So I don't think that's a good thing, but there's not an easy way around that in the current situation.
Obviously, I'm a green person. I don't understand all of this. I find it fascinating. But I hear you use words like a 1 trillion bubble wealth disappears, shrinking the financial sector. Everything is going down. We here at the Madison Institute and other places have had Herman Daly and John Cobb come and talk about the no-growth economy. We've had Josh Farley. I was out of town that day, so I didn't hear that. And right now, those of us in the green community are talking about where we need to go is the no-carbon steady-state economy. And we need to make that shift now and as fast as possible. I don't know all the ins and outs of what you're talking about, and some of my family members have been hurt a lot by the recession. But overall, I look at this shrinking and recession as a good thing, that we need to cut our whole wealth that down about a third. And can you comment on the long-term positive benefit for the environment, which of course, if we don't fix that, we're all cooked.
Well, I don't think the route to improving the environment is through high unemployment and a collapsing economy. I mean, I think the route to improving the environment is through a well-working economy. And obviously, it's not doing that today. We're not, so we can have a well-working economy that's green, and it's a question of getting the incentives right, getting the resources in the right places. You know, that's why I was mentioning before, people work fewer hours, shorter work years, shorter work weeks. Odds are they would use up less resources. And, you know, again, I think that's a trade-off most people would be willing to make in most circumstances. Maybe not everywhere, but let's try and give the incentives the right way. There are any number of things we could do to green the economy that they don't mean worse living standards. I mean, we use up a huge amount of resources in transportation to and from work. Well, if people travel to and from work less, then, you know, we would use up less resources. Our homes could all be more energy efficient. We, you know, even for a same size home, people get smaller homes in many cases because they have bigger homes than they need. But even a same size home, we use up much more, you know, energy, heating and cooling it than, say, people in Europe who think they have comparable living standards. Maybe they don't know better, but they think they do. So there's an awful lot of things we can do that are going that would reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by large amounts. It does take time, but I think we can do it. And I think the way to do it is by having a strong economy rather than trying to do it with a weak economy so that, you know, people can't afford the things and they're just sitting there. I mean, it's disastrous. People are losing their homes. Their families are breaking up. They can't afford health care. I can't see that be the way to go. I think it's a question of getting our policies right.
I think this will be the last question. I'm speaking on behalf of the questioner back here, who wanted your thoughts on how might China retaliate if there were this change in the exchange rate.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's this "we should be scared of China" story, which I really dislike. Well, I really dislike two reasons. I mean, one is it's not true. The other is I think it's kind of racist. That we're supposed to be really, really worried about China. First off, in terms of China's ownership of our debt, anyone who wants to talk about that should be talking about the dollar and the trade deficit. When they start talking about the budget deficit, they're not being honest with you. Because the amount that China owns of our debt depends on the trade deficit. That's how they get dollars to buy U.S. assets. And if they didn't buy government bonds, they could buy outstanding government bonds. You know, we already have plenty outstanding, so they don't, you know, maybe with a balanced budget, they could buy up the outstanding government bonds. Or maybe they'll buy shares of GE stock and Apple stock, and then if one day they wanted to get U.S. government bonds any time, well, they could sell those any day of the week and buy up U.S. government bonds. So this idea, this link of the budget deficit to China, it's not true. It's appealing to nationalistic, racist sentiments. It's really just silly. Now, let's imagine that China, for whatever reason, they weren't happy with our policies, you know, because of the dollar or, you know, maybe our military policies, foreign policy, whatever it might be. Suppose, you know, the thing we're supposed to be very scared of, that they're just going to dump, you know, they're holding somewhere on the order of $1.5 trillion, maybe as much as $2 trillion. They're going to dump it on world markets. Well, should we be worried about that? Well, if they were to do that, what would that mean? It would mean that the dollar would fall against the yuan. The yuan would rise again. Isn't that what we're asking them to do? It's not something that brings out the fear in me. And, you know, let's take the extreme case. You know, we have this huge flight from the dollar. Everyone's really scared. They look at the U.S. dollar and they go, that's not a good government. They don't know what they're doing. You know, we're going to dump the dollar. Okay, so the dollar goes, you know, currently it's 7-1 to a dollar. It becomes, you know, 3.5. You know, currently it's like $1.4 to a euro. It goes to $3 to a euro. Currently a dollar get you about 100 yen. Suppose it only get you 50. All right, well, in that world, suddenly we're not importing anything from China, from Europe, from Japan, from Canada. Are they going to be happy with that? And on top of that, our goods are selling at half price in all those countries. So we're driving them out. The United States has just become super competitive. They're not going to be happy with that. So in that story, what would almost certainly happen is the European Central Bank would start buying up dollars like crazy, and the Canadian Central Bank, and the Chinese Central Bank, and the Japanese Central Bank. They would not let the dollar go into a free fall. We're not Zimbabwe. Okay, and I'm saying that in all seriousness. I mean, we are a large integrated economy. If we suddenly saw a huge fall in the value of the dollar, that hurts other countries in many ways more than it hurts us. They would not allow it to happen. So it's not even a plausible story. So this scare story that these people are circulating is entirely their invention. It can never happen. I mean, now, someone could go, okay, suppose we go 10 years out, our trade deficit's 20% of GDP, our manufacturing sector's completely shriveled up. I know it's shrunk, but it's still damn big. You know, suppose it's completely, you know, yeah, then it could happen. But we're a long, long way from that. So this scare story is really an invention. It just is not something that deserves to be taken seriously.
Now, Dean asked us one question, and I know a bit of the answer, and maybe some of the rest of you know more, and that was whether we have a work-sharing program in Wisconsin. And we have had one. I'm not sure how much it's being used right now, but it actually was at a time when Mitch was working on the alternative work patterns thing in Washington, and we passed some laws here for job sharing, which was quite successful, and we were encouraging it in schools especially because it was very valuable for teachers and for kids sometimes to have more people available as teachers. I think if you haven't had all your questions answered, you must remember that there is a book that has a great deal of what Dean Baker has told us in it. It's a small book. It's easy reading. It's nice, big print. It's lightweight, and you can hold it. And I know that while Gene Farley was waiting for Dean's plane to come in, he was able to read a lot of it. So I encourage you. The gift shop here has that book for sale, and I think that Dean is willing to sign it. So that will be out in the hall out here. And I think we owe Dean a great deal of thanks for all his information today.
Thank you.
The foregoing program featured Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. His most recent book is False Profits: Recovering from the Bubble Economy. To hear other thought-provoking programs, please go to our website at www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the sponsor.